All right, we continue in the second missionary journey, Acts, the 17th chapter. That's where we are. If you're visiting with us, Paul is preaching for the first time in Europe, and he's already made several stops, and the missionary journey is going very well. He's converted several souls already. He's established local churches, and I say he, but of course we give God the glory. It's God who's adding the increase. But Paul is the vessel or the instrument that God is using, along, of course, with Silas and Timothy and Luke even at times. And so we see that everything is going well. There's a fine church now at Philippi. We've made a mention of the fact that that church becomes really one of Paul's favorite, if not the favorite local church, that is, of Paul. At least they sustain a relationship with him that's more loving than any other, more giving than any other. They're the ones that support him financially, even in the preaching of the gospel, even at a time when no other church was supporting him. And so when you read the book of Philippians, you see terms of endearment that are used with regard to them that aren't used with regard to any other local church. So he obviously is very close to them. And that church was established on this second missionary journey. And then, of course, we see the establishment of the church at Thessalonica and Berea. And now Paul is traveling to, or has traveled to, Athens. And we'll pick up there. Athens, of course, is, as we stated, I think, in our last lesson, we were making mention that Athens is a great, great city. And that is, of course, just a historical fact, especially with regard to ancient Athens, going back into the B.C. era, that it was, at that time, one of the greatest cities on earth. And at its peak was maybe one of the greatest cities that there has ever been. It led the way in all kind of areas of art and education, philosophy. It was the chief city in all of those areas. And some of the greatest philosophers that lived back in that particular period of time, some of the greatest statesmen and historians, all called Athens their home. And so it was a great, great city. In fact, it was such a great city that finally, when it fell to Rome and Rome conquered Athens, they allowed Athens to remain a free city. And that's not something Rome did a whole lot of, but Athens was just that great of a city. Now, in Paul's day, of course, it has lost a lot of its political clout. It really doesn't have any political power in the first century, and it's lost its military strength. Back in the B.C. time, it was so strong militarily that it was able even to fight off the great Persian army on two occasions. But now it's lost all of that. It's not a military force, not a political force any longer in the first century. But it remains an educational force. It remains probably the greatest city or seat of education in the Roman Empire. It was still known as a great university city. A lot of people came from various parts of the Roman Empire to be educated at Athens. And so it remained to be that even in Paul's day. But it was an impressive city. And when you walk, even in the first century, it still had all of its architecture and all of that. And it would be inspiring to walk through it and see all of the different things that have been built. And you would think that would immediately impress Paul, one who was highly educated himself. But we see as we go through this that Paul was interested in something else other than just architect, and the greatness even of the reputation of Athens, all of that seemed not to overly impress Paul. Because there was something that was more important that disturbed him. So we'll see that in just a second, but let's just pick up at verse 15 of Acts chapter 17. It says, "And now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they left." And so remember, I think I made mention of this. Paul has been, for the most part, except for on occasion, just briefly, that these journeys have been taken by foot. But now Athens is 200 miles away from Berea. So on this occasion, he goes by sea and lands at a seaport about 2 miles away, 2 to 5 miles away from Athens. And he has to then walk from that seaport to Athens. And it's on that road that he would see all of these various idols and that sort of thing. And probably it's at this time that he sees this altar built to the unknown God that is on the inscription. And so, but he walks that way to Athens. Then verse 16 says, "And now while Paul was waiting for them," that is for Silas and Timothy, "at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols." And we made mention of that, but I think it's worth repeating there. I mean, here's Paul again. He's not impressed with all the greatness of this city. He is upset, angered. This word provoke means to be agitated, to be irritated or aroused to anger. And so it's not just that he is distressed by it. There is distress there, of course, with Paul, but he is really angry as he sits there and waits, and as he looks around, perhaps even walked around the city some, that he sees all of these idols, all of these shrines, all of these temples that are made and built at Athens. He sees all of that, and he's angry. He would be angry because, first of all, that would rob God of his glory. All of these many idols. Remember we said that in Athens, one Roman historian said that there were probably more idols in Athens than men. And so everywhere you went, on every street, there would just be idols all over the place. And that was Athens. They were proud of that. And so that to Paul, that would be something that was disrespectful to God. It would rob him of his glory, and it made him mad. And no doubt, Paul, of course, was a lover of souls. He would understand that in a city like this, full of idols, that would mean, of course, ultimately, that souls were being lost, that souls were under the captivity of the devil. And that would make him mad. And he would be angered by the fact that this city was a stronghold of Satan. All of those kind of things. You might can think of other things. But as Paul just was thinking, now he's kind of in a waiting mode. He's waiting for Silas and Timothy to come and so that they could get to work. But the more he looks around, he gets angry and more angry. And he just can't wait. And so he begins then to proclaim the gospel of Christ. Verse 17 says, "So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present." So there's several things we can point out here. First of all, think about us in our situation. We don't live in a city like Athens, obviously. Or do we? In a sense, as you stop and think about it, are we surrounded by idols today? We are, aren't we? Our idols are a little bit different. We don't have shrines and certainly temples built to some Greek goddess or anything like that. We don't have that, but we're surrounded by idols. This is a city. This is a country. We might even today say a world full of idolatry. On every hand, it might now be money that is our God. It might be our jobs. It might be education. Whatever, we're just surrounded by idols, things that we give a higher priority to than God. We have allowed a lot of things to displace God in our hearts. And if not us as Christians, certainly society has done that. There's little doubt about that. And it should make you mad. And we should be angered by the things that are going on in the world, and particularly in this country, ought to anger us. When you see groups of people, masses of people that are turning away from God and disrespecting God in so many different ways, how can we just be untouched by that? Paul saw all of that in a city that under normal circumstances would have just thrilled Paul to be in. Remember, Paul, again, as I said earlier, he was an educated man. Grew up in Tarsus, which was a great city, no mean city itself, the King James says about Tarsus. He sat at the feet of Gamaliel. He was highly educated. In this sermon that we'll be going over in a few minutes, I think, or maybe next time we meet, depending on if we get to it, that he has the ability to quote Greek poets. He was aware of the different philosophies that the Greeks had. In his sermon, you can tell that he's preaching against some of the popular philosophies of the Greeks because he's aware of all of that. He's very educated. And in normal circumstances, in the city that was the seat of education amongst the Greeks, he would be thrilled to go there. He'd be like a tourist going from place to place and taking pictures at this site. But he wouldn't like that at all, because the thing that was most important to Paul was God. He was the most important person to God. And what was most important to him was winning souls for God. And so his anger really took the place of all of that awe-inspiring feeling that he may have had under normal circumstances. But what about us? We go from place to place. Are we even moved at all by all of that idolatry, by all of the disrespect, by all of the souls that are captive to the devil? Does that touch us at all? It ought to. And we ought to be angry. But our anger should be manifested the same way that Paul's was manifested. Sometimes we can be angry. We can have even righteous indignation and sometimes express it the wrong way. In fact, some people in this country of ours, they demonstrate anger, obviously, but something more than that, maybe insanity. When you think about individuals blowing up abortion clinics, is that a good thing? Of course not. Now, we oppose abortion, don't we? We understand what that is. It's murder, and we know that. We ought to teach against it and preach against it, but blowing up an abortion clinic isn't the answer, is it? It's not how you demonstrate righteous indignation. Or even in this society of ours, again, as we all know, with homosexuality, same-sex marriage, all of that, the answer is not going out and beating up a homosexual, is it? That's not the way you manifest righteous indignation. Paul was angry, but he manifested that anger. He turned that anger in the right direction. It resulted in him doing what? Reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and then in the marketplace. That's how you get God glory, by preaching the gospel. That's how you save the souls who are now under the dominion and captivity of the devil. You preach the gospel of Christ. And that's what Paul did. And it's interesting here that Luke doesn't say much about this visit to the synagogue here. It just says that he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. Now, in the other times when Paul went into the synagogue, Luke would give us detail of how they responded. He didn't tell us anything about how they responded here. And maybe they didn't respond much at all. And that's why he just passes by. You do get the sense as you read this. Now, here is a synagogue in the midst of this city full of idolatry. And you could get the impression that the Jews were kind of grew indifferent to the whole thing. That since they're located in this city, they've gotten used to all of this idolatry. And again, they're just like Paul. They couldn't go anywhere without seeing idols. They should have been just as upset as Paul, shouldn't they? Sometimes it's easy in a society that's so full of sin to get used to it and to compromise. And after a while now, you start seeing things, and at first you think, oh, that's just terrible. And after a while, though, you begin to think, oh, you know, nothing of it. It's just the way it is. That's just this country. And so we begin to no longer be affected by it. And that's the first step. And then after a while, when sin no longer bothers you, then you begin to justify it even in other people. And I understand why they do this or do that. And next step is you find yourself participating in the sin, whatever it is. And so it's always good to have what Paul had, to have a righteous indignation towards sin. Sin ought to always disturb you. Right when you get to the point where sin doesn't make you mad or sin doesn't disturb you or sin doesn't make you uncomfortable, right when you get to that point, a red flag should go up. You need to begin to reconsider, think through what it is, what sin does, and the consequences of it. Because it ought to make us mad. And we ought to be just like Paul. But he demonstrated, he worked that anger in his heart caused him to do the right thing, and that is preach the gospel. So he goes into the synagogue and he preaches there. Then he goes into the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. And the marketplace was a place where they would again sell things and be involved in business up until about noon. And then after that, the business would stop and people would gather there just to talk about various philosophies. So at verse 18 it says, and also some of the Epicureans and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. And so they would be in the marketplace again once it got to that point where the business was over and they started talking about philosophy and new things, then the Epicureans and the Stoics would be there. There were other groups of philosophies in Athens, but these were the two major ones, and that's no doubt why Luke mentions them here. The Epicurean, they were followers of a fellow by the name of Epicurus. You can maybe guess that. And he was a person who first of all, basically their philosophy was that they ought to avoid pain and pursue pleasure. And that was the Epicurean philosophy. Now, it wasn't quite as bad as it sounds. It maybe got worse and worse as time went on. But the pleasure that they pursued basically was the absence of pain. And even more than that, an understanding of how the universe works and things of that nature. And so it was more of an intellectual pursuit is what would bring ultimate pleasure. Now, no doubt it degraded to sensual and pleasures of the flesh with some Epicureans. But at its heart, the idea, the philosophy of the Epicurean was that they ought to be happy, do everything they could to be happy and to avoid pain. And we have any folks like that in the world today? They may not be followers of Epicurus, but we have a lot of folks like that. That's their philosophy of life. And they basically believed that the world came about by chance. So they dismissed the idea of God altogether. The Stoics, on the other hand, they were different. They were on the opposite end of the spectrum. They basically were more noble. And they had virtue to some extent. But they believed that the world came about by fate. So that what was going to happen was going to happen no matter what. So they went through life. Their attitude was you ought to just really avoid any kind of pleasure. That should not be your interest. And at the same time, just accept any pain that comes into your life. It's just a matter of fate. Nothing you can do about it anyway. What's going to happen is going to happen. And so don't care about pleasure and don't worry about pain. Just grin and bear it when it comes. And that was the Stoic philosophy. The Stoics were followers of a man by the name of Zeno, and they're called Stoics simply because this Zeno would teach in Athens on the painted porches of Athens, and the Greek word for porch is stoa, so they were called Stoics. But that was their philosophy. They were under control so far as their passions and emotions were concerned. They kind of like Mr. Spock. Anybody watch Star Trek? just keep everything under control. You have no real feelings. All your feelings and passions are completely under control. Anger, completely under control. And so there's a nobility about that kind of thing. But none of it is traced back to God. That's the problem. And so it's just based on their belief that everything happens by the fates. They did believe, unlike the Epicureans, they believed that God created the heavens and the earth. They thought that Zeus did it. But that again, then after Zeus created, everything else was in control or controlled by the fates, even Zeus himself. So, and that's just the way it was. And so again, what was going to happen was going to happen. So you just accept whatever it is, good or bad, that happened and keep your emotions under control. So these two groups of people, and there again were other philosophers, no doubt, but these were the two major ones. And so they're in the marketplace. They're conversing with Paul. Some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? And that was a great insult to call Paul a babbler. The word babbler there means basically a seed picker. And it was used in different ways. It began to be used of birds that would come down, swoop down, and pick up the seeds of the field. And then they started to use it in a figurative way to denote people who would walk around even in the marketplace and pick up scraps. And so it would describe the beggar who just wanted scraps of things and would beg for things. And that, and they're using it to, again, figuratively describe Paul as someone who has picked up scraps of information from this philosophy and that philosophy. And now he's trying to push it off as if they're his own. And so it was really a great insult to Paul when they called him a babbler. But notice it says, others, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities. So you have these different groups saying these negative things about Paul. By the way, what do most people do when a gospel preacher sets forth truth that they don't like? What's a lot of people going to do? They're going to turn their ears. But what else? By way of that would be a lot of people do it. They just turn their ears, just ignore it. But some people will take a more aggressive approach. They do what? They hate the messenger. And so they paint a bad picture of the messenger. You know, someone doesn't like what you teach. Well, you know, did you know this about Don Wright? Did you know he did this one time? And all of a sudden, you try to discredit the preacher or the messenger and thereby discredit the message. And that's exactly what they're doing with Paul. Whether it's as sinister as that or not, that's what a lot of people do today on purpose. Yeah.
That's something to be aware of too as we live our lives. If you hear that about somebody, you bring up a biblical position or we'll say a religious position that you're not sure of. Mm-hmm. And somebody says, for example, Don Wright teaches this. What do you think to another whatever? And then they start criticizing you as a person.
Yeah.
That should signal you that something... he's not comfortable with defending what he's trying to defend, so he's trying to discredit you. So it can be a way of picking out false teachers as well.
Yes.
People go about doing this.
Very good. Very good. That's exactly right. And I agree with that 100%. We have to keep our ears open to that because that is an approach. Now, we know it's an approach. It goes all the way back to Athens, but it's an approach taken over and over again. So when you hear someone, and I'm not, you know, Brett said it first, so. But it seems self-serving for me to say. But when you hear someone saying something negative about a preacher, you know, sometimes it might be true. But don't just take it, because sometimes that's exactly what people are trying to do. Discredit the message by discrediting the messenger. And so that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing here, at least when they call him a babbler. That was an insult without question. The second one here seems to be perhaps a misunderstanding of what Paul was saying. Notice the second part of that he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities. You see, that's plural, because he was preaching Jesus in the resurrection. What it appears is if some of these philosophers, as they heard Paul preach, that they were thinking that he was talking about two separate deities. Jesus would be one, the resurrection would be another deity. And so they thought that he was setting forth deities. They didn't know anything about Jesus or this, what they thought to be a goddess resurrection, whoever that was. They didn't know anything about that. So they ultimately wanted to hear more about these about these deities that he's bringing up. But that shows, again, more ignorance than anything else. And so what did they do? They took him then, brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is which you are proclaiming. And so now this Areopagus is an interesting place. It used to be perhaps the greatest court in the world. Remember, Athens used to be a great, great city politically and otherwise. And the people of Athens and others who were powerful would sit in this court. Areopagus was actually the name of the court. It would be like our Supreme Court is what it was. And so they would judge everything from homicide to moral things and that sort of thing. And it was renowned worldwide. And then also, it came to represent not only that court, but a place. So the Areopagus was both a court and a place. I think the King James might indicate somehow in there that the Areopagus is Mars Hill. And that is because the there was a hill right in the middle of Athens where this was located. And it was referred to as the hill of Ares in the Greek. Ares was a Greek god of war. The Roman god of war was Mars. So a god by the name of Mars. And so it was called the hill of Mars or Mars Hill. And so it was both a court and the people who made up the court, the members of the court, and then it was referring to the place itself. In this text, it is referring to the place that it would be both. The court has lost its clout again. It's no longer powerful. But they brought Paul to a group of men, but it was actually on Mars Hill that they brought him. And so they brought him to this particular place. Now, there are some who think that they took him to a place in the marketplace that is now called Areopagus. But I didn't see that verified or proven in any way. Most commentators believe that they took him to this hill in the middle of the city of Athens that they refer to as the Areopagus. But he is standing before a group of people now. And this, you could tell by the language here that this is not a trial per se. Usually, when you're brought before the Areopagus, you're on trial. And this isn't that. It's not, at least, there are no witnesses or anything like that. Paul is not in a lot of trouble or anything like that. He's not being tried, per se. They just want to question him because the Athenians are like that. They want to hear. They've heard of Jesus and the resurrection. Now they want to investigate more about this whole situation. And so they bring him to Mars Hill. And it says at verse 20, for you are bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know about these things. Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. So it says in verse 22 that Paul stood up in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. That's a hard word to get a grasp on. If you have the King James, it probably uses the word superstition. Superstitious. And this is a word that's probably not what they are being described as is probably not as bad as, you know, people just being superstitious. And religion might be too soft. It's probably in between those two ideas. The Athenians, they were simply a group of people who believed, like a lot of the Greeks, in a plurality of gods. And they feared them all. So they had a fear of gods. They were religious from that standpoint, as religious as anybody that Paul had come across in these missionary journeys. They had a respect for all of the gods. And again, within the Greeks, that isn't extremely unusual. We talk about the Greeks as being atheistic. And of course, from our point of view, they were atheistic. They didn't believe in the true and living God. But they were a lot of the Greeks were very religious. And so they had a respect for all of the various gods. It might explain why, in fact, it does explain why in Athens you had so many idols and shrines. They didn't want to leave out any god. They didn't want to accidentally make any god mad. And so they had all of these idols. But Paul sees this, and certainly he's not complimenting the Athenians at all, but it's not a scathing rebuke either. He just pointed out, you all are just a little bit too religious. Can people be too religious today? Is that possible? There's some people who just accept just about anything and don't want to make anybody mad, so they just accept any kind of religious theory or religious philosophy. And a lot of people like that. That does, in fact, when you stop and think about it, even within the realms of denominationalism, how many denominations think that all denominations are right? Don't want to offend any denomination, because any path is okay. Just believe in Jesus. Doesn't matter what denomination you're a part of. And so a lot of people, that is a common view. That's why you hear, join the church of your choice. Because nothing really matters. Doctrine doesn't matter so much. I mean, your doctrine's okay, and my doctrine's okay, and it's all good. And so let's not offend each other, make anyone mad. Let's just accept everything. And there's some people like that. And so, but these people were like that with regard to idolatry. They were like that. They just accepted any God that they hear of. That's why they want to hear more about Jesus and the resurrection. Let's hear about these deities. We've not ever heard of these deities. Let's hear about these deities. Well, that just opened up the door for Paul, didn't it? And so it gives him the opportunity to preach, and the opportunity to preach in a very respectable place. Again, while this court has lost its clout, it still has a great reputation in Athens, being the center of education. And so this affords Paul a pretty good opportunity. So the first thing he does, says, well, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar to this inscription, to an unknown God. And that sort of verifies again. That was a just in case altar. they have all these, most of these idols and things, they represented specific deities amongst the Greeks and even the Romans. But they put one up to the unknown God, just in case they missed one. They weren't taking any chances. And so, but to Paul, that represented an opportunity, because again, that showed him they're too religious. They believe in just about anything, and they certainly have somewhat of a conscience about all of this. So he says, therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. And of course, he is referring to God himself. Verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. That would strike a chord immediately with the Epicureans. They didn't think God created the heavens and the earth. They think everything came about by chance. Anybody today think this world came about by chance? That's most of the people in our society, or many of the people in our society today. At least people that are part of our the greatest educational institutions that we have. They're all these scientists and whatever think everything happens by chance. Paul's saying, no, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. You can't confine him. There are all these temples around. And all these temples, they have the one on another kill that was right close to the Areopagus was the Pantheon that had a 39-foot statue of Athena. And so there she is, stands before the door in this man-made temple. And Paul, of course, aware of all of that. But he says, the God that I'm talking to you about now, he doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. You can't confine him just to that. That's impossible. He's greater. He's far greater than that. Not only that, he says, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. That's the God that we serve. That's still relevant today, isn't it? For us to recognize who God is. He is the creator of the heavens and the earth. He is a God who is so great that he doesn't need us. We need him. And we forget that sometimes. I think I mentioned earlier on in the first missionary journey about the Greeks, how that they would put meat out, food out on their altars for their gods. So that while they were sleeping at night, then their gods would come along and take the food. And in that way, they were providing for their gods. And that was common Greek philosophy. That was their belief. That's what Paul is addressing here. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. God is self-sustaining. He's self-sufficient. He doesn't need us. He doesn't need our service. I've often said, there isn't anything you can do in the entirety of your life that somehow improves the existence of God. He doesn't need you or me even a little bit. The only reason he demands that we serve him and worship him is because that's a demonstration of our love. But he doesn't need us at all. The Greeks' philosophy and how they approached their deities really made their gods dependent upon them. Paul is saying, the God that I'm preaching to you now, he's not dependent on us. We're dependent on him. And he continues to make that point. Verse 26, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitations, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. Now, that was the second bell, so we had to quit here. But something very powerful there at the beginning of verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth. That renders racism absolutely ridiculous. The person who is a racist is the most ignorant person that you could ever have, because he doesn't realize that there's only one race. There's only one blood. We all are traced back to Adam.
Yeah. People don't realize that was dealt with extensively as the church was first established and then started growing, when you started mixing Jews and Gentiles, and how God told everybody that we were all one in the body of Christ, and
yes,
trying to get that message across that all men are equal before him.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the exact same thing.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. We need to get back to understanding we're all one blood. We'll talk about that more. Appreciate your time.